Doomsday Book, Cassette 17.
Colin didn't come in the morning, and after lunch, Dunworthy walked to the public phone again and rang Finch. I haven't been able to find a doctor willing to take on new cases, Finch said. I've telephoned every doctor and medic within the perimeter, and a good many of them are still down with flu, he apologized. And several of them... He stopped. But Dunworthy knew what he had intended to say. Several of them had died, including the one who would certainly have helped, who would have given him the inoculations and discharged Badri. Great Aunt Mary wouldn't have given up, Colin had said. She wouldn't have, he thought, in spite of the sister and Mrs. Gadsden and the band of pain below the ribs. If she were here, she would have helped him, however she could. He walked back to his room. The sister had posted a large placard reading, Absolutely no visitors allowed, on his door, but she was not at her desk or in his room. Colin was, carrying a large, damp parcel. The sister's in the ward, Colin said, grinning. Miss Piantini very conveniently fainted. You should have seen her. She's very good at it. He fumbled with the string. The nurse just came on duty, but you needn't worry about her either. She's in the linen room with William Gadsden. He opened the parcel. It was full of clothing, a long black doublet and black breeches, neither of them remotely medieval, and a pair of women's black tights. Where'd you get this? Dunworthy said. A production of Hamlet? Richard III, Colin said. Treble did it last term. I took the hump out. Is there a cloak? Dunworthy said, sorting through the clothing. Tell Finch to find me a cloak. A long cloak that will cover everything. I will, Colin said absently. He was fumbling intently with the band on his green jacket. It sprang open, and Colin threw it off his shoulders. Well, what do you think? He had done considerably better than Finch. The boots were wrong. They looked like a pair of gardener's Wellingtons. But the brown burlap smock and shapeless grey-brown trousers looked like the illustration of a serf in Colin's book. The trousers have a strip, Colin said, but you can't see it under the shirt. I copied it out of the book. I'm supposed to be your squire. He should have anticipated this. Colin, he said, you can't go with me. Why not? Colin said. I can help you find her. I'm good at finding things. It's impossible. Oh, now you're going to tell me how dangerous it is in the Middle Ages, aren't you? Well, it's rather dangerous here, isn't it? What about Aunt Mary? She'd have been safer in the Middle Ages, wouldn't she? I've been doing lots of dangerous things, taking medicine to people and putting up placards in the wards. While you were ill, I did all sorts of dangerous things you don't even know about. Colin, you're too old to go alone. And Great Aunt Mary told me to take care of you. What if you have a relapse? Colin, my mother doesn't care if I go. But I do. I can't take you with me. Can't just sit here and wait, he said bitterly. And nobody will tell me anything. And I won't know whether you're alive or dead. He picked up the jacket. Not fair. I know. Can I come to the laboratory at least? Yes. I still think you should let me go, he said. He began folding the tights. Shall I leave your costume here?
Better not. The sister might confiscate it.
What's all this, Mr. Dunworthy? Mrs. Gadsden said. They both jumped. She came into the room, bearing her Bible.
Colin's been collecting for the clothing drive, Dunworthy said, helping him wad the clothing into a bundle. For the detainees.
Passing clothes from one person to another is an excellent way of spreading infection, she said to Dunworthy. Colin scooped up the bundle and ducked out.
and allowing a child to come here and risk catching something. He offered to come and walk me home from the infirmary last night, and I said, I won't have you risking your health for me. She sat down next to the bed and opened her Bible. It's pure negligence, allowing that boy to visit you. But I suppose it's no more than what I should have expected from the way you run your college. Mr. Finch has become a complete tyrant in your absence. He simply flew at me in a rage yesterday when I requested an extra roll of lavatory paper. I want to see William, Dunworthy said. Here? She sputtered. In hospital? She shut her Bible with a snap. I simply won't allow it. There are still a great many infectious cases, and poor Willie is in the linen room with my nurse, he thought. Tell him I wish to see him as soon as possible, he said. She brandished the Bible at him like Moses bringing down the plagues on Egypt. I intend to report your callous indifference to your students' well-being to the head of the history faculty, she said, and stormed out. He could hear her complaining loudly in the corridor to someone, presumably the nurse, because William appeared almost immediately, smoothing down his hair. I need injections of streptomycin and gamma globulin, Dunworthy said. I also need to be discharged from hospital, as does Badri Chowdhury. He nodded. I know. Colin told me you're going to try to retrieve your historian. He looked thoughtful. I know this nurse. A nurse can't give an injection without authorization by a doctor, and the discharges will require authorization as well. I know a girl up in records. When do you want this by?
Soon as possible.
I'll get right on it. Might take 2 or 3 days, he said, and started out. I met Kivrin once. She was at Balliol to see you. Very pretty, isn't she?
I must remember to warn her about him, Dunworthy thought, and realized he had actually begun to believe he might be able to rescue her in spite of everything. Hold on, he thought. I'm coming. 2 or 3 days.
He spent the afternoon walking up and down the corridor, trying to build his strength up. Badri's ward had an absolutely no visitors allowed placard on each of the doors, and the sister fixed him with a watery blue eye each time he approached them. Colin came in wet and breathless with a pair of boots for Dunworthy. She has guards everywhere, he said. Mr. Finch says to tell you the net's ready, except he can't find anyone to do med support.
Tell William to arrange it, he said. He's taken care of the discharges and the streptomycin injection.
I know. I've got to deliver a message to Badri from him. I'll be back. He did not come back, and neither did William. When Dunworthy walked to the phone to ring Balliol, the sister caught him halfway and escorted him back to his room. Either her tightened defences included Mrs. Gadsden as well, or Mrs. Gadsden was still angry over William. She did not come all afternoon. Just after tea, a pretty nurse he hadn't seen before came in with a syringe. Sister's been called away on an emergency, she said.
What's that?
He asked, pointing to the syringe. She tapped the console keyboard with one finger of her free hand. She looked at the screen, tapped in a few more characters, and came around to inject him. Streptomycin, she said. She did not seem nervous or furtive, which meant William must have managed the authorization somehow. She injected the largish syringe into the cannula, smiled at him, and went out. She had left the console on. He got out of bed and went round to read what was on the screen. It was his chart. He recognized it because it looked like Badri's and was as unreadable. The last entry read, ICU,
1580-2691, 14-1-55, 1805, 150-RPT, 1800-CRF, 1MSTMC, 4ML-Q6H, NHS-40-211-7M, Arend.
He sat down on the bed. Oh, Mary.
William must have obtained her access code, perhaps from his friend in records, and fed it into the computer. Records was no doubt far behind, swamped by the paperwork of the epidemic, and had not yet got to Mary's death. They would catch the error some day, though the resourceful William had no doubt already arranged for its erasure. He scrolled the screen back through his chart. There were M. Aron's entries up through 8155, the day she had died. She must have nursed him until she could no longer stand. No wonder her heart had stopped. He switched the console off so that the sister wouldn't spot the entry and got into bed. He wondered if William planned to sign her name to the discharges as well. He hoped so. She would have wanted to help. No one came in all evening. The sister hobbled in to check his tack bracelet and gave him his temp at 8 o'clock, and she entered them in the console, but didn't appear to notice anything. At 10, a second nurse, also pretty, came in, repeated the streptomycin injection, and gave him one of gamma globulin. She left the screen on, and Dunworthy lay down so he could see Mary's name. He didn't think he would be able to sleep, but he did. He dreamed of Egypt and the Valley of the Kings. "Mr. Dunworthy, wake up," Colin whispered. He was shining a pocket torch in his face.
"What is it?"
Dunworthy said, blinking against the light. He groped for his spectacles. "What's happened?"
"It's me, Colin," he whispered.
He turned the torch on himself. He was wearing, for some unknown reason, a large white lab coat, and his face looked strained, sinister in the upturned light of the torch.
"What's wrong?" Dunworthy asked. "Nothing," Colin whispered. "You're being discharged."
Dunworthy hooked his spectacles over his ears. He still couldn't see anything.
"What time is it?"
he whispered.
4 o'clock.
He thrust his slippers at him and turned the torch on the closet.
"Do hurry."
He took Dunworthy's robe off the hook and handed it to him.
"She's likely to come back any moment."
Dunworthy fumbled with the robe and slippers, trying to wake up, wondering why they were being discharged at this odd hour, and where the sister was. Colin went to the door and peeked out. He switched the torch off, stuck it in the pocket of the too large lab coat, and eased the door shut. After a long breath-holding moment, he opened it a crack and looked out.
"All clear,"
he said, motioning to Dunworthy.
"William's taken her into the linen room."
"Oh, the nurse?"
Dunworthy asked, still groggy.
"Why is she on duty?"
"Not the nurse, the sister. William's keeping her in there till we're gone."
"What about Mrs. Gadsden?"
Colin looked sheepish.
"She's reading to Mr. Latimer," he said defensively. "I have to do something with her, and Mr. Latimer can't hear her."
He opened the door all the way. There was a wheelchair just outside. He took hold of the handles.
"I can walk," Dunworthy said.
"There isn't time," Colin whispered. "And if anyone sees us, I can tell them I'm taking you up to scanning."
Dunworthy sat down and let Colin push him down the corridor and past the linen room and Latimer's room. He could hear Mrs. Gadsden's voice dimly through the door reading from Exodus.
Colin continued on tiptoe to the end of the corridor, and then took off at a rate that could not possibly be mistaken for taking a patient to scanning, down another corridor, around a corner, and out the side door where they had been accosted by the end of time is near sandwich board. It was pitch black in the alley and raining hard. He could only dimly make out the ambulance parked at the street end. Colin knocked on the back of it with his fist, and an ambulance attendant jumped down. It was the medic who had helped bring Badri in, and had picketed Bravenose. "Can you climb up?" she asked, blushing. Dunworthy nodded and stood up. "Pull the doors to," she told Colin, and went round to get in the front.
"Don't tell me she's a friend of William's," Dunworthy said, looking after her.
"Of course," Colin said. "She asked me what sort of mother-in-law I thought Mrs. Gadsden would be."
He helped him up the step and into the ambulance.
"Where's Badri?"
Dunworthy asked, wiping the rain off his spectacles. Colin pulled the doors too.
"At Balliol. We took him first, so he could set up the net."
He looked anxiously out the back window.
"I do hope Sister doesn't sound the alarm before we're gone."
"I shouldn't worry about it," Dunworthy said.
He had clearly underestimated William's powers. The ancient sister was probably on William's lap in the linen room, embroidering their intertwined initials on the towels. Colin switched on the torch and shone it on the stretcher.
"I brought your costume," he said,
handing Dunworthy the black doublet. Dunworthy took off his robe and put it on. The ambulance started up, nearly knocking him over. He sat down on the side bench, bracing himself against the swaying side, and pulled on the black tights. William's medic had not switched on the siren, but she was going at such a rate she should have. Dunworthy clung to the strap with one hand and pulled on the breeches with the other, and Colin, reaching for the boots, nearly went over on his head.
"We found you a cloak," Colin said. "Mr. Finch borrowed it off the Classical Theatre Society."
He shook it out. It was Victorian, black and lined in red silk. He draped it over Dunworthy's shoulders.
"What production did they put on? Dracula?"
The ambulance lurched to a stop, and the medic yanked open the door. Colin helped Dunworthy down, holding up the train of the voluminous cloak like a page boy. They ducked in under the gate. The rain pattered loudly on the stones overhead, and under the sound of the rain was a clanging sound.
"What's that?" Dunworthy asked, peering out into the dark quad.
"When at last my saviour cometh," Colin said. "The Americans are practicing it for some church thing. Necrotic, isn't it?"
"Mrs. Gadsden said they were practicing at all hours, but I'd no idea she meant 5 in the morning.
"Concerts tonight," Colin said.
"Tonight?"
Dunworthy said, and realized it was the 15th, the 6th on the Julian calendar. Epiphany. The arrival of the wise men. Finch hurried toward them with an umbrella.
"Sorry I'm late," he said, holding it over Dunworthy. "But I couldn't find an umbrella. You've no idea how many of the detainees go off and forget them, especially the Americans."
Dunworthy started across the quad.
"Is everything ready?"
"The med support's not here yet," Finch said, attempting to keep the umbrella over Dunworthy's head. "But William Gadsden just telephoned to say it was all arranged and she'd be here shortly."
Dunworthy would not have been surprised if he had said the sister had volunteered for the job.
"I do hope William never decides to take to a life of crime," he said.
"Oh, I don't think he would, sir. His mother would never allow it."
He ran a few steps, trying to keep up.
"Mr. Choudhury's running the preliminary coordinates, and Miss Montoya's here."
He stopped.
"Montoya? What is it?"
"I don't know, sir. She said she had information for you."
"Not now," he thought. Not when we're this close. He went in the laboratory. Badri was at the console, and Montoya, wearing her terrorist jacket and muddy jeans, was leaning over him, watching the screen. Badri said something to her, and she shook her head and looked at her digital. She glanced up and saw Dunworthy, and an expression of compassion came into her face. She stood up and reached in the pocket of her shirt. No, Dunworthy thought. She walked over to him. I didn't know you were planning this, she said, pulling out a folded sheet of paper. I want to help. She handed him the paper. This is what information Kivrin had to work with when she went through. He looked at the paper in his hand. It was a map. This is the drop. She pointed to a cross on a black line. And this is Skengate. You'll recognize it by the church. It's Norman, with murals above the rude screen and a statue of St. Anthony. She smiled at him. The patron saint of lost objects. I found the statue yesterday. She pointed to several other crosses. If by some chance she didn't go to Skengate, the most likely villages are Estcote, Tenafeld, and Shrivendon. I've listed their distinguishing landmarks on the back. Badri stood up and came over. He looked even frailer than he had in the ward, if that were possible, and he moved slowly, like the old man he had become. I'm still getting minimal slippage, no matter what variables I feed in, he said. He put his hand under his ribs. I'm running an intermittent opening for 5 minutes at 2-hour intervals. That way we can hold the net open for up to 24 hours. 36, if we're lucky. Dunworthy wondered how many of those 2-hour intervals Badri would hold up for. He looked done in already. When you see the shimmer, or the beginnings of moisture condensation, move into the rendezvous area, Badri said. What if it's dark? Colin asked. He had taken off the lab coat, and Dunworthy saw that he was in his squire's costume. You should still be able to see the shimmer, and we'll call out to you, Badri said. He grunted softly and put his hand to his side again. You've been immunized?
Yes.
Good. All we're waiting for, then, is the med support. He looked hard at Dunworthy. Are you sure you're well enough to do this?
Are you? Dunworthy asked.
The door opened, and William's nurse came in, wearing a slick. She blushed when she saw Dunworthy. William said you needed med support. Where would you like me to set up?
I must remember to warn Kivrin about him, Dunworthy thought.
Badri showed her where he wanted her, and Colin ran out after her equipment. Montoya led Dunworthy over to a chalked circle under the shields.
Are you going to wear your spectacles?
Yes,
he said. You can dig them up in your churchyard.
I'm certain they won't be there, she said solemnly. Do you want to sit or lie down?
He thought of Kivrin, lying with her arm across her face, helpless and blind.
I'll stand, he said.
Colin came back in with a steamer trunk. He set it down by the console and came over to the net. You've no business going by yourself, he said.
I must go by myself, Colin.
Why?
Too dangerous. You can't imagine what it was like during the Black Death.
Yes, I can. I read the book through twice, and I've had my...
He stopped.
I know all about the Black Death. Besides, if it's as bad as all that, you shouldn't go by yourself. I wouldn't get in the way, I promise.
Colin, he said helplessly. You're my responsibility. I can't take the risk.
Badri came over to the net carrying a light measure.
The nurse needs help with the rest of her equipment, he said.
If you don't come back, I'll never know what happened to you, Colin said. He turned and ran out.
Badri made a slow circuit of Dunworthy, taking measurements. He frowned, took hold of his elbow, took more measurements. The nurse came over with a syringe. Dunworthy rolled up the sleeve of his doublet. I want you to know I don't approve of this at all, she said, swabbing Dunworthy's arm. Both of you properly belong in hospital. She plunged the syringe in and walked back to her steamer trunk. Badri waited, while Dunworthy rolled down his sleeve and then moved his arm, took more measurements, moved it again. Colin carried a scan unit in and went back out without looking at Dunworthy. Dunworthy watched the display screens change and change again. He could hear the bell ringers, an almost musical sound with the door shut. Colin opened the door and they clanged wildly for a moment while he maneuvered a second steamer trunk through the door. Colin dragged it over to where the nurse was setting up and then went over to the console and stood beside Montoya, watching the screens generate numbers. He wished he had told them he would go through sitting down. The stiff boots pinched his feet, and he felt tired from the effort of standing still. Badri spoke into the ear again, and the shields came down, touched the floor, draped a bit. Colin said something to Montoya, and she glanced up, frowned, and then nodded and turned back to the screen. Colin walked over to the net.
What are you doing? Dunworthy said.
One of the curtain things is caught, Colin said. He walked to the far side and tugged on the fold.
Ready? Badri said.
Yes, Colin said, and backed away toward the prep door. No, wait. He came back up to the shields. Shouldn't you take your spectacles off, in case someone sees you come through?
Dunworthy removed his spectacles and tucked them inside his doublet.
If you don't come back, I'm coming after you, Colin said and backed away. Ready, he called.
Dunworthy looked at the screens. They were nothing but a blur. So was Montoya, who had leaned forward over Badri's shoulder. She glanced at her digital. Badri spoke into the ear.
Dunworthy closed his eyes. He could hear the bell ringers banging away at, "When at last my savior cometh." He opened them again.
Now, Badri said.
He pushed a button, and Colin darted toward the shields and under, straight into Dunworthy's arms.
Chapter 33 They buried Rosamond in the grave the steward had dug for her.
You will have need of these graves, the steward had said. And he was right. They would never have managed to dig it themselves. It was all they could do to carry her out to the green. They laid her on the ground beside the grave. She looked impossibly thin, lying there in her cloak, wasted almost to nothing. The fingers of her right hand, still half curved around the apple she had let drop, were nothing but bones.
Heard you her confession? Roche asked.
Yes, Kivrin said. And it seemed to her that she had. Rosamond had confessed to being afraid of the dark and the plague and being alone, to loving her father, and to knowing she would never see him again.
all the things that she herself could not bring herself to confess. Kivrin unfastened the love knot pin Sir Blowett had given Rosamond and wrapped the cloak around her, covering her head, and Roche picked her up in his arms like a sleeping child and stepped down into the grave. He had trouble climbing out, and Kivrin had to take hold of his huge hands and pull him out. And when he began the prayers for the dead, he said,
Nomine ad adjuvandum me festina.
Kivrin looked anxiously at him. We must get him away from here before he catches it too, she thought, and didn't correct him. We don't have a moment to lose.
Dormiant in somno pacis,
Roche said, and picked up the shovel and began filling in the grave. It seemed to take forever. Kivrin spelled him, chipping at the mound that had frozen into a solid mass and trying to think how far they could get before nightfall. It wasn't noon yet. If they left soon, they could get through the Witchwood and across the Oxford Bath Road onto the Midland Plain. They could be in Scotland within the week, near Invercassley or Dunach, where the plague never came. Father Roche, she said, as soon as he began tamping down the dirt with the flat of the shovel. We must go to Scotland.
Scotland?
He said, as if he had never heard of it. Yes, she said. We must go away from here. We must take the donkey and go to Scotland. He nodded.
We must carry the sacraments with us. And ere we go, I must ring the bell for Rosamond, that her soul may pass safely into heaven.
She wanted to tell him no, that there wasn't time. They must leave now, immediately. But she nodded. I will fetch Balaam, she said. Roche started for the bell tower, and she took off running for the barn before he had even reached it. She wanted them to be gone now. Now, before anything else happened, as if the plague were waiting to leap out at them like the bogeyman from the church or the brewhouse or the barn. She ran across the courtyard and into the stable and led the donkey out. She began to strap his panniers on. The bell tolled once and then was silent, and Kivrin stopped, the girth strap in her hand, and listened, waiting for it to ring again. Three strokes for a woman, she thought, and knew why he had stopped. One for a child. Oh, Rosamond. She tied the girth strap and began to fill the panniers. They were too small to hold everything. She would have to tie the sacks on. She filled a coarse bag with oats for the donkey, scooping it out of the grain bin with both hands and spilling whole handfuls on the filthy floor, and knotted it with a rough rope that hung on Agnes's pony's stall. The rope was tied to the stall with a heavy knot she couldn't untie. She ended by having to run to the kitchen for a knife and back again, bringing the sacks of food she had gathered up earlier. She cut the rope free and sliced it into shorter sections, threw down the knife, and went out to the donkey. He was trying to gnaw a hole in the sack of oats. She tied it and the other bags to his back with the pieces of rope and led him out of the courtyard and across the green to the church. Roche was nowhere in sight. Kivrin still needed to fetch the blankets and the candles, but she wanted to put the sacraments in the panniers first. Food, oats, blankets, candles, what else had she forgotten? Roche appeared at the door. He was not carrying anything. Where are the sacraments? She called to him. He didn't answer. He leaned for a moment against the church door, staring at her, and the look on his face was the same as when he had come to tell her about the miller. But they've all died, she thought. There's nobody left to die.
I must ring the bell, he said, and started across the churchyard toward the bell tower.
You've already rung it, she said. There's no time for the funeral now. We must start for Scotland. She tied the donkey to the gate,
her cold fingers fumbling with the rough rope, and hurried after him, catching him by the sleeve. "What is it?" He turned almost violently toward her, and the expression on his face frightened her. He looked like a cutthroat, a murderer.
"I must ring the bell for Vespers,"
he said, and shook himself violently free of her hand. "Oh, no," Kivrin thought. "It is only midday," she said. "It isn't time for Vespers yet." "He's just tired," she thought. "We're both so tired we can't think straight." She took hold of his sleeve again. "Come, Father. We must go if we're to get through the woods by nightfall."
"It is past time," he said, "and I have not yet rung them. Lady Hermione will be angry."
"Oh, no," he thought. "Oh, no, oh, no." "I will ring it," she said, stepping in front of him to stop him. "You must go into the house and rest."
"It grows dark," he said angrily.
He opened his mouth as if to shout at her, and a great gout of vomit and blood heaved up out of him and onto Kivrin's jerkin. "Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no." He looked bewilderedly at her drenched jerkin, the violence gone out of his face. "Come, you must lie down," she said, thinking, "We will never make it to the manor house."
"Am I ill?"
he said, still staring at her blood-covered jerkin. "No," she said. "You are but tired and must rest." She led him toward the church. He stumbled, and she thought, "If he falls, I will never get him up." She helped him inside, bracing the heavy door open with her back, and sat him down against the wall.
"I fear the work has tired me," he said,
leaning his head against the stones.
"I would sleep a little."
"Yes, sleep," Kivrin said. As soon as he had closed his eyes, she ran back to the manor house for blankets and a bolster to make him a pallet. When she skidded in with them, he was no longer there. "Roche," she cried, trying to see up the dark nave. "Where are you?" There was no answer. She darted out again, still clutching the bedding to her chest. But he wasn't in the bell tower or the churchyard, and he could not possibly have made it to the house. She ran back in the church and up the nave, and he was there, on his knees in front of the statue of St. Catherine. "You must lie down," she said, spreading the blankets on the floor. He lay down obediently, and she put the bolster behind his head.
"It is the plague, is it not?"
he asked, looking up at her. "No," she said, pulling the coverlid up over him. "You're tired, that's all. Try to sleep." He turned on his side away from her. But in a few minutes he sat up, the murderous expression back, and threw the covers off.
"I must ring the Vespers bell," he said accusingly,
and it was all Kivrin could do to keep him from standing up. When he dozed again, she tore strips from the frayed bottom of her jerkin and tied his hands to the rude screen. "Don't do this to him," Kivrin murmured over and over without knowing it. "Please, please, don't do this to him." He opened his eyes.
"Surely God must hear such fervent prayers," he said,
and sank into a deeper, quieter sleep. Kivrin ran out and unloaded the donkey and untied him, gathered up the sacks of food and the lantern, and brought them inside the church. He was still sleeping. She crept out again and ran across to the courtyard and drew a bucket of water from the well. He still did not appear to have wakened, but when Kivrin wrung out a strip torn from the altar cloth and bathed his forehead with it, he said without opening his eyes.
I feared that you had gone.
She wiped the crusted blood by his mouth.
I would not go to Scotland without you.
Not Scotland, he said. To heaven.
She ate a little of the stale manchet and cheese from the food sack and tried to sleep a little, but it was too cold. When Roche turned and sighed in his sleep, she could see his breath. She built a fire, pulling up the stick fence around one of the huts and piling the sticks in front of the rude screen, but it filled the church with smoke, even with the doors propped open. Roche coughed and vomited again. This time, it was nearly all blood. She put the fire out and made two more hurried trips for as many furs and blankets as she could find, and made a sort of nest of them. Roche's fever went up in the night. He kicked at the covers and raged at Kivrin, mostly in words she couldn't understand, though once he said clearly, "Go, curse you!" And over, furiously, "It grows dark." Kivrin brought the candles from the altar and the top of the rood screen and set them in front of St. Catherine's statue. When his ravings about the dark got bad, she lit them all and covered him up again, and it seemed to help a little. His fever rose higher, and his teeth chattered in spite of the rugs heaped over him. It seemed to Kivrin that his skin was already darkening, the blood vessels hemorrhaging under the skin. "Don't do this, please." In the morning, he was better. His skin had not blackened after all. It was only the uncertain light of the candles that had made it seem mottled. His fever had come down a little, and he slept soundly through the morning and most of the afternoon, not vomiting at all. She went out for more water before it got dark. Some people recovered spontaneously, and some were saved by prayers. Not everyone died who was infected. The death rate for pneumonic plague was only 90%.
This ends side one of cassette 17. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.